a couple of miles through Sherwood until we emerged from the trees onto the lawn of a grand estate I'd been to a few times before. As we drove, I could feel subtle webs of magic woven throughout the path along the road. We were moving too fast for me to get much out of what I could sense, but the implications were pretty clear. Lara had blanketed her grounds in magical protections of some kind. Now, where had she gotten someone to do that for her? Wraith Manor was a brooding chateau, built in the rural French style from some point in the 18th century, only with more gargoyles and Gothic features that vaguely called Notre Dame to mind, you know, before the fire. Our cars parked out front, and Riley came over to open my door for me. "We'll secure your car while you're inside, sir," he said, and held out his hand for my keys. Securing my car could mean a lot of things, among them tearing it apart to look for bugs and bombs. I eyed him. "After you've acknowledged my guest right," I said. "You are Ms. Wraith's guest and are under her protection," he confirmed. I grunted and handed him the keys. Then I walked up the steps for several seconds, Riley moving behind me. I opened the door and went inside like I owned the place. The big old house was a dark and brooding structure, even on a sunny day. On a dark night, it looked like a set from a Scooby-Doo cartoon. There was little light inside, just a few subtle spots here and there on art that was scattered throughout the place. I started to turn to ask Riley where everyone was, but Riley had stopped at the door and shut it carefully, leaving me alone in the dimness. I wasn't alone for long. There were the firm clicks of someone approaching in heels over hardwood floors. I didn't want to assume it was a woman. Wraith Manor was that kind of place. A tall figure in a close-fit black business suit approached me through one of the swaths of dim light. Dark red hair cropped close to her head, intent sea-green eyes, with scar tissue at their corners. She moved like an athlete and looked about 30, but something about the way she regarded me as she came closer made me wary, and I took note of the fact that her knuckles were swollen with scars.
"Good evening, Mr. Dresden," she said, smiling slightly. "If you will follow me, I'll take you to Ms. Wraith."
"Yeah, okay," I said, and we started walking deeper into the manor. The place looked like it had been furnished by the Louvre. I'd lived in apartments that cost less to build than a few square feet of the chateau. It took me maybe 20 seconds to be pretty sure of my guess.
"What, did Vatterong throw some kind of bargain basement sale on renting out his Valkyries?"
"Monarch Securities provides consultants in many places, sir," the redhead said. She gave me a smile with maybe four teeth too many in it, and her voice turned into a purr. "Though I'd be interested to hear what you mean by bargain basement."
Valkyries were superhumanly strong, swift, and tough, and had the kind of experience that comes with agelessness. And they didn't just like fighting, they lusted for it. I'd seen a Valkyrie in action before. I didn't particularly want to take one on for funsies, and this Valkyrie walked with the kind of steady, inevitable confidence that said that walls would be well advised to stay out of her way.
"It wasn't an insult for you personally," I said. "I'm playing." "Don't I look playful to you?" she asked.
"You look like you play rough," I said. The woman let out a laugh that came straight up from her belly.
"You've got eyes, and you use them," sighed Amada. She regarded me speculatively. "Most men don't know how to show some respect."
"You have much trouble correcting them?"
"No, I don't," she said calmly. "My sister says you're all right in a bad spot."
"Sister?" I asked.
"Oh, Sigrun Guard?" "Obviously," she said. She offered me her hand. "Freydis Guard."
"Harry," I took her hand. She had a grip like a pneumatic clamp, and my bandaged hands were sensitive. Ouch!
feet gentle with me.
She laughed again. I've heard some about you, but you must be something special. Lara doesn't let anyone interrupt this part of her day.
It's probably easier than replacing the landscaping, I said.
That must be it, Freitas said. She came to a door, stopped, and gave me an utterly incongruous Vanna White kind of gesture toward it. And here we are.
So I opened the door and went through it, into the Wraith Dojo.
I mean, when you've got 5 gazillion rooms in a house, one of them obviously needs to be a dojo.
Sure.
The room was brightly lit, a stark contrast to the rest of the place. The walls were white and had a number of white silk banners hanging from them, marked with black kanji that had been painted on. I knew enough to recognize the lettering, but not enough to read it. The practice floor was smooth wood with tatami matting over much of it. A woman wearing a white kimono was in the middle of the practice floor, with one of the smooth round staves called a bow in her hands. She was flowing through a practice routine that had the weapons whirling in an arcing blur around her and before her. The sound of the weapon cutting the air, faster than a vanilla human could have moved it, was a steady hiss. She turned and faced me, still striking, spinning, thrusting at the empty air. Lara Wraith had cheekbones that could split atoms, bright gray-silver eyes capable of boring through plate steel, and a smile that could turn crueler than a hook-tipped knife. Her blue-black hair was long and would have fallen to the small of her back if it hadn't been bound up into a messy bun. She froze in the midst of her routine, body coming to an utter halt, transforming her from a dervish into a mannequin. The demonstration of perfect control was more than a little impressive and interesting. But that was Lara. I had never been in her presence without feeling an intense attraction for her, and I wasn't at all sure it was because she was a vampire of the White Court, and the closest thing to a succubus that you could find this side of hell. It had more to do with her. Lara was as beautiful and dangerous as a hungry tigress, and very, very smart. She met my eyes for a second and then gave me an edged smile.
You want to talk to me right now, Harry? She said. Take off your shoes and pick up a bow.
Oh, come on, I said. She arched an eyebrow.
I don't give anyone my practice time, she said. This is my house. You came to me. Take my terms or leave them, Dresden.
I exhaled. Doing what she asked was an acceptable way for her to get around the traditional protections of my guest right. After all, if we were in the dojo training and something bad happened to me, it could be a regrettable accident. Combat training is dangerous in its own right, after all. Or, I suppose, she could claim I had attempted to assassinate her, just as Thomas had tried to take out Etri. In fact, I could sort of see a harebrained logic in Lara attempting to muddy the waters around Thomas's situation by creating a similar one with me. And casting blame at a wider conspiracy. Cockamamie nonsense, but someone desperate enough to help family might reason themselves into it. I chewed on my lip. But not Lara Wraith. Not her style at all. Lara was the slipperiest and cagiest vampire in a basket of psychotic sociopaths. I didn't really see her as the same kind of hedonistic monster as many other White Court vamps I had met. She was something much more dangerous than that. She was disciplined, rigidly self-restrained, and she didn't give way to either the demonic parasite that made her a monster or anyone else who would try to force her into doing something she didn't want to do. If Lara wanted me dead, it would have happened already. It would have been abrupt, swift, and well executed, and I probably wouldn't have had much of a chance to respond. I might never realize it had happened. I'd seen Lara fight, and she'd seen me do the same. Neither one of us would be interested in giving the other a chance to fight back. But I was on the clock here.
Wasting time wrangling with Lara over protocol wasn't going to help my brother. So I set my jaw and kicked off my sneakers. Lara watched that, and her smile turned a shade wicked.
Good boy.
Now you're just being obvious, I said, and sat down to take off my socks. I rose, left my duster on, and picked up a bow of my own from a simple wooden rack of them to one side of the training floor. I flexed my injured hands and winced in discomfort. The pain was already growing more distant as the winter mantle flooded distressed nerve endings with a distant sensation of nothing but cold. I walked around Lara to stand in front of her and took up a ready position, gripping the staff loosely, with most of it extended out in front of me at waist level, like someone holding out a pitchfork of hay. Lara turned to me and bowed at the waist, smiling.
European.
Murphy had shown me plenty of Asian stuff, too, but I didn't want Lara to know about that. I learned in Hogwalla, Missouri, I said, but my first teacher was a Scot.
I spent much of the 18th century in Japan.
She took up a ready position of her own, staff held vertically with the lower end angled out toward me. I thought it was closed to all outsiders then. She grinned and moved her hip in a little roll that made me want to stampede.
Have you looked at me?
Ugh, right, I said. Her smile turned warmer.
What do you want, Harry?
I snapped my staff at her in a simple thrust. She parried easily and countered with a hard beat that came so fast that it nearly took the weapon out of my hand. I recovered the weapon and my balance, retreating from a strike that hit the mat where my bare foot had been an instant earlier. The blow landed hard enough to send a crack like a home run hit through the room.
Hell's bells, Lara, I said. Pain is the best teacher, she said. I don't pull hits. You shouldn't either.
She came at me in a hard, fast strike at the level of my ankles. I caught it on the end of my staff in the nick and flicked her weapon back.
You heard about Thomas. And your visit to him, and your visit to Justine later, yes, she said. What did he tell you?
I shook my head. All he said was Justine, and he barely said that. They busted up his mouth pretty good. I launched another exchange from outside Lara's reach and drove her across the mat. She was tall for a woman, but I'm tall for anybody. I probably had most of a foot of advantage in reach on her, and I started using it. The staves cracked together over and over, and I barely avoided getting my knuckles shattered. She was faster than me and more skilled in a purely technical sense. But that wasn't the only thing that decided real fights. This was bear versus mountain lion. If she got caught somewhere, I could put my power and endurance to good use. She'd be the one in trouble. I kept pressing her toward the corners of the mat, and she kept slipping to one side without ever leaving it, one step ahead of me. But there are other ways to slow people down.
My people are covering Justine, Lara said. She's as safe as I can make her without sequestering her here.
She's pregnant, I said. Lara missed a step, and I was ready. I thrust the tip of my bow at her knee. She avoided it, but only by taking the hit in the meat of her calf through the kimono, and she hissed in pain. She countered with a strike to my head that I ducked, and then she came back up onto one leg, weapon ready to defend or attack, her eyes narrowed. If this had been for real, the fight would have been over in moments, or at least the foreplay would. We'd both been shifting toward using supernatural abilities, and God only knew what kind of chaos would play out. I drew back, grounded the end of my bow, and bent at the waist in a slight bow. Lara regarded me warily and then mirrored me as best she could on one leg, which was excellently.
You're sure? Lara demanded a moment later, rolling the ankle on that leg several times.
Thomas was, I said.
And they didn't tell me?
Lara pressed her lips together. Then she shifted her grip to a more aggressive stance, something like mine, and I came onto guard to match her. We thrust and parried for a moment, circling.
Have you told his grandfather about him? She asked.
I faltered at that, and Lara sent a thrust at me that hit me square in the belt buckle and shoved me off my feet and onto my ass.
I sat on the floor for a moment, eyeing Lara, who grounded her staff and bowed exactly as I had and regarded me calmly. She knew about Thomas and me. I mean, I'd been aware of that, but she'd put together enough to work out who Ebenezer was, too. The White Court had a reputation for being insidious subversives. Connections to them, regardless of their source, were regarded with what most of the supernatural world considered healthy suspicion. If Ebenezer's connection and mine to the White Court became public knowledge, the ramifications for our current situation were sticky. And Ebenezer didn't just have issues with vampires. He had volumes and ongoing subscriptions. It had the potential for a real humdinger of a mess. "I've known from the beginning," she said impatiently, as if she'd been reading my thoughts. "I was here when my father was so obsessed with your mother. He made me play nanny to Thomas. I often heard them talk, because apparently no one in my family understands what a deadly weapon the ability to listen can be. And she left Thomas in my care once when she visited McCoy. And after she died, I helped Father hang her portrait in his psychotic little egomaniac's gallery." I nodded. "But you never brought it up, never used it for leverage."
"No," she said, "because I'm also the one who changed Thomas's diapers after his mother escaped our father. Dressed him, fed him his meals, taught him to read."
She shook her head, her eyes focused on one of the banners.
"I'm more ruthless than most, Dresden. But even for me, there are limits. Most of those limits involve family."
"That's why you didn't use it against him," I said. "How come you didn't use it against me?"
"You never gave me good reason to fight quite that dirty," she replied.
"And I couldn't have used it against you without exposing my brother to trouble as well."
"Then you know why I want to help him," I said.
"We both do."
"Then get him out," I said. "You can do that, right? Work something out with Etri and his people?"
Her features shifted subtly, changed. Somehow they became paler, more like marble, less like something that belonged to a living human person.
"Impossible."
"Nothing's impossible," I said. She held up one slim, white hand.
"As the situation stands, yes it is. I've been shown the preliminary evidence. Thomas entered their embassy under false pretenses, less than 10 minutes after the beginning of the armistice for the peace talks, and attempted to murder their king. On camera. If I do anything but deny and disavow his actions, Etri will have little choice but to assume that I sent Thomas to kill him."
"Etri's people look all stuffy, but they have Viking sensibilities," I said quietly.
"Yes," Lara replied. "If they believe I've tried to harm Etri, they will begin a war I am not at all certain I care to fight."
She let out a laugh that had something of a hysterical edge on it.
"Thomas couldn't have screwed this up any harder if he'd had a year to plan it."
"There's got to be something you can do," I said. "What about the Wehrguild?" Lara grimaced.
"The Svartalf who died, Austri," I said. "His name was Austri."
She regarded me for a moment, her expression troubled.
"Austri, then. He died defending a head of state. This is an offense against the Svartalfs as a nation, not just an individual. Wehrguild is what leaders use when they both want to avoid conflict. Etri doesn't."
She shook her head again. "Our brother is beyond my political reach." I scowled.
"Well, what have you got all these marines for, then?"
Lara eyed me as if I'd been a child missing the slowest, easiest pitches she could throw at me.
"If I tried to have him forcibly taken from Svartalf territory, not only would that represent a major military effort to face the dragon in its den, it would mean violating their sovereign territory as defined in the Accords. Mab wouldn't remain neutral then. She'd be obligated to help them. She might even send her hatchet men after me."
She shook her head.
"I might be willing, and able to go up against Etri and his people for my idiot brother, if there's no other way. But I cannot and will not lead my people into a mass suicide by Svartalves and Mab and the rest of the Accorded Nations. She looked away at one of the banners in its kanji and seemed for a moment ashamed. Even within my own court, my authority has limits. If I tried such an irrational thing, they'd depose me. I exhaled slowly. She said nothing for a moment. Why? I asked her. Why did he do it? She shook her head. I had hoped that you would know something I didn't, wizard. It wasn't my doing, and he didn't give me the least indication that it was going to happen. Presumably to provide me with enough deniability to avoid a war. Which, I suppose, indicates that somewhere within the idiocy he meant well. Fighting is out, I said. Yes, and talking is out, so it would seem. But we've got to do something. Lara's expression became entirely opaque. Obviously, I am open to ideas. We have to create more options, I said. She nodded, her expression pensive. I'll be working the room at the Fate tomorrow night. Perhaps some leverage might be attainable there. Possible, perhaps. I shook my head as I rose. Our brother is going to die if we don't do something. If you can't be bothered to... Lara came at me in a black and white and silver-eyed blur that covered 20 feet in less time than it took me to blink. She caught the front of my duster in her pale hands and whirled me into the mat with enough force to make me see stars. By the time I'd brushed a few of them out of my field of view, Lara was astride me, one hand twisted into my duster, one hand lifted knife-like and rigid, ready to sweep down at my throat. Do not, she hissed, leaning closer toward me, presume to tell me what my family is worth to me, or what I am willing to do for them. I didn't have a whole lot to say to that. Both of us panted. I found myself staring at her mouth. Lara's eyes brightened, glittered like mirrors. She stared at me for a second, breathing heavily herself with the exertion of moving so swiftly. I was intensely aware of the sensation of her weight on me. So was my body. But then my body is always overly enthusiastic. More to the point, the winter mantle was going berserk. The mantle didn't just come with access to nifty fey power sources and greater physical speed and strength. Winter was the spiritual home of all things primal and primitive. They were hunters, raiders, takers. Don't search the winter court of the Shi for a hug. You won't find one anywhere that doesn't collapse your ribs into your spine. But if you want savage, animalistic sex, yeah, you've come to the right place. I mean, you might get torn to pieces in the process, but in winter, them's the breaks. The mantle thought that Lara was a fantastic idea, that she needed someone to tear those clothes off her and spend several hours with her in heavy physical exertion, and it thought that someone ought to be me. My body was backing up that concept. It backed it up so strongly that I felt the slow, sensual tension slide into my muscles, pressing my body against her a little more firmly wherever we were in contact. Oh, Lara breathed quietly. Her eyes shone like mirrors. I looked down and away from them, lest things get even more complicated. It was little improvement. It meant I could see one of her legs, positioned out to one side, and it had come clear of the folds of the kimono. Her skin was flawless and pale over absolutely glorious musculature. Even her feet were pretty. She leaned closer and inhaled through her nose. The proximity made me feel dizzy, among other things. I focused through the, well, not pain, but the need was rapidly building in that direction. I pushed my body's stupid ideas away and spoke in a calm, level voice,
Lara, I said quietly.
Yes, she breathed.
Is it involuntary, I asked her, or are you using the come hither on me on purpose? I tried for a calm, bright, conversational tone. It came out a hell of a lot lower and quieter and huskier than I meant, because at the moment the only thing I could really think very much about was how much I wanted to toss her onto a bed and start ripping off clothing. There wasn't any thought or emotion behind that drive, just the primal physical need of a body screaming for satisfaction. I wondered if she was feeling something similar. Her pale eyes stared steadily at my face, and she looked like she was thinking about something else. It took her a moment to lick her lips and answer.
It's some of both. I can use it whenever I wish to, but I can't always choose when not to use it.
I swallowed. Then get off me. At least I got the words in the right order. This is a business trip. I came here to try to find a way to help Thomas not to get frisky with an apex sexual predator.
Lara blinked at me, and her eyes darkened by several shades. Her mouth turned up into a slow, genuine smile.
What did you call me? She asked.
You heard me, I said. Some of the tension eased out of her. A moment later, she flowed to her feet and withdrew a few steps from me. I had to force myself to leave my hands down, rather than grabbing at her clothes as she drew back.
Well, she said, you aren't wrong.
I exhaled slowly and clubbed the winter mantle and its stupid primal drives back into the back seat. I wasn't sure I was exactly relieved that Lara had withdrawn, but it was probably simpler that she had. She turned away and said,
the more power one has, the less flexible it is, wizard.
She shook her head.
The White Court is mine, but I cannot lead it to its destruction over actions this reckless. Not even for my idiot brother.
She shook her head.
Unless things change, I will have no choice but to disavow him.
Without your support, I said very quietly, he has no chance at all. She closed her eyes and exhaled. Then she turned to me, her gaze intense, her eyes now a gray so deep that they were nearly blue, and said,
no, Harry.
He still has one. I swallowed and said, oh, me.
Chapter 15. The Munstermobile wasn't exactly designed for speed. It didn't have power steering or power brakes, just power. And it got about 2 gallons to the mile. I settled in for the drive back. Riley and the machine gun Hummer review escorted me back to the front gates. I turned out of the estate and onto an unlit country road that would take me back to the highway. We'd reached the witching hour, and the summer night was overcast, pregnant with heat and rain that hadn't fallen. The windows started steaming over as Vampire Graceland receded behind me, and I cranked them down laboriously. My brother was in trouble, and Lara wasn't going to be any help. I thought furiously about how to get him out. The White Council wasn't going to be of any use unless Lara went to them with a formal request, an action that would have to happen openly, and which Etri's people would be sure to regard as a tacit admission of guilt regarding Thomas. Mab wouldn't help Thomas. His only use to her was as a replacement knight should anything happen to me. And she could have been deceiving me about that. She didn't do things for the sake of kindness. If I was unable to show her the profit to Winter in saving my brother, she would care no more about him than about the floor she walked on. My only 2 sources of diplomatic muscle weren't going to be any help, and I was pretty sure that I couldn't get into a fully on-alert Svartalf stronghold and drag him out all by myself. That would be a suicide mission, just as Thomas's had been.
If I went in and took along friends for support, would it count as a murder-suicide? God, I felt sick and tired. Stupid corner hounds. Stupid allergy meds. What was I going to do? My stomach rumbled. I debated hitting an all-night burger franchise when I got to the highway. On the one hand, my body definitely needed the fuel. On the other hand, my stomach felt like it would probably object to adding much of anything to it. I was fumbling in my pockets for a coin to flip when gray shapes loomed up in the road in front of me. I stood on the brakes and left broad swaths of rubber on the road behind me as I fought the big old car to a halt. I wound up with the nose of the car pointing into the weeds and the headlights casting a harsh cone of white light, partly over the road and partly over the thick trees that hemmed it in. I killed the engine and stared out the driver's side window at the four wardens who barred my way. Ramirez stood in the middle of the crew and slightly forward, leaning on his cane, his dark eyes steady. He'd have been the first one to meet Bumper if I hadn't been able to stop the car. Gone were the casual civilian clothes. He was dressed in the White Council's version of tactical gear, complete with his gray warden's cloak. To his right stood Wild Bill Myers. Wild Bill had filled out a lot as he got into his late 20s, adding on the muscle and solidity of a maturing body. He'd grown his beard out, and it wasn't all skinny and patchy like it used to be. Kind of reminded me of Grizzly Adams now. His cloak was shorter on him than it had been when we'd started the war with the Red Court. Wild Bill hadn't been done growing yet. Rather than one of the enchanted swords most of the established wardens carried, Wild Bill had a Bowie knife he'd been working on steadily for years. It rode his belt across from a .45-70 big frame revolver that weighed as much as my leg. In the shadows cast to the left side of the road by my headlights stood Yoshimo, who refused to let anyone call her by her first name. It had taken Ramirez a couple of years to find out that it was Yukie, and I'm pretty sure she hadn't forgiven him. She was a girl of Okinawan heritage, about 5'4", and she carried a katana on her hip and an assault rifle on a strap around one shoulder. She could use either of them like a Hong Kong action movie star. The fourth member of Ramirez's crew stood to his left, looking steadily into my headlights. He was a slim, very dapper young man dressed in a camel-colored bespoke suit and wearing a neatly complimentary bowler hat. Chandler had indulged in experimental facial hair as well, and currently sported a thick, fierce Freddie Mercury mustache. It could have looked dopey with his outfit, but Chandler, being Chandler, he carried it off with panache. Maybe the strictly ornamental walking cane helped. He was the only one of the four not geared up for a fight. But then Chandler always made a point to uphold the forms of civilization harder than were strictly necessary. The five of us had been through more than a little together, though Chandler had been our handler and point of contact, not usually a field guy. None of them were smiling. I could recognize game faces when I saw them. Harry, I thought to myself, these kids might be here to hurt you. I sat in the car for a moment while the engine clicked. Then I said, in the future, you guys should probably look for a crosswalk, or maybe an adult to hold your hand. We need to talk, Harry, Ramirez said. Got a minute? I eyed him and then mused. How'd you pull off the tracking spell? Right wrist, he said. I eyed him, then held up my right hand and peered. I had to turn my thumb until it faced almost all the way away from me to spot the dot of black ink on the outside of my wrist. Ramirez held up his right hand and wiggled his pinky finger, where an identically shaped ink spot marked his skin. Wow, I said in a level tone. Mistrusting me right from the get-go, huh? He shrugged. I was pretty clear about my intentions, he said. If you don't want others to think you're shady, man, maybe you shouldn't be doing shady things at shady times with shady people,
He nodded back the way I'd come, toward the chateau. Come on, Harry, it's us. Make this simple. Talk to me. Maybe you don't know about my life's relationship with Simple, I said. I eyed Ramirez, then the others. Hey, guys, what's up? Yoshimo gave me her samurai face. Wild Bill lifted his chin, an almost unconscious gesture of acknowledgement. Chandler rolled his eyes at them and walked forward, extending his hand and speaking in a precise Oxford accent. Harry, good to see you, man. Ramirez and the others tensed as Chandler walked into their lines of fire, a term that among wizards could become especially literal. I took the opportunity to get out of the Munstermobile and regard his extended hand with a skeptically lifted eyebrow. Chandler's cobalt blue eyes sparkled and he held up his hand, showing me his fingers. I inspected them minutely, then traded grips with Chandler in a hearty handshake, eyeing Ramirez over the shorter man's head as I did. How's the PhD work coming? I asked him. Viciously political, he said, smiling. History is such a thorny thing on the continent. Most people can't just go talk to folks who were alive for it, I imagine, I said. Precisely. Maddening, Chandler said. I'm sorry we're doing this, Harry, but you've got to admit, old boy, you've had a damned peculiar day, or so it would appear from the outside. I responded with a genial frown and duplicated his accent badly. Oh, really? How so, if you do not mind me asking? Chandler's smile didn't falter, but it took on an aspect of granite somehow. No one's that disingenuous, Dresden. The Winter Lady gets you quarters inside the Svartalf Embassy. Not long after, a known personal agent of Lara Wraith and a frequent ally of your own gets inside, somehow, and attempts to assassinate Etri. Hours later, you visit the assassin's significant other, then have a meeting with Ms. Wraith. I said. Sure, I mean, when you put it like that, see how that might look a little suspicious. We've a long tradition of twisty thinking in my homeland, Chandler said. Perhaps it has made me cynical and uncharitable, but it occurs to me that there are a disturbing number of connections in these events. It makes one wonder if you've been entirely honest with us. I held up my wrist so that the spot of black ink Ramirez had put there was showing. You are going to lecture me about being open and honest? And seriously, ink? After the last time around with an actual traitor in the council? What were you thinking? Chandler arched an eyebrow. He glanced over his shoulder at Ramirez and said, Fair points. He took a step closer and lowered his voice. But all the same, Dresden, it's damned peculiar. Perhaps it's time you leveled with us, I believe is the vernacular. I studied Chandler's face for a moment and then looked at the other wardens. How'd you decide who would be the good cop? I asked him quietly. Rock, paper, scissors? Don't be daft, Chandler replied. As an academic, I find myself dealing with temperamental potential lunatics on a regular basis. I was the obvious choice, and we drew straws. Lunatic, huh? I asked. There have been certain questions about how much of your will remains your own. Yes, Chandler said frankly. I am my own man, more or less, I told him. Yes, well, you would think that, wouldn't you? Chandler said with a wry smile. You see our predicament. Matters are unfolding here that we don't quite understand. We have an interest in learning as much as possible. The way he said we was something new. He wasn't using the word as an inclusive one, like we are all friends. He was using it as an exclusive term. We, all of us, not you. He was referring to me as someone outside of the White Council. His bright blue eyes were direct, almost pleading as he said it, willing me to get the message. I saw recognition flicker in them as he saw me process what he was actually saying.
Be advised, Harry. The White Council now considers you a threat. Didn't bode too well for that vote.
Got it, I said, looking away from his eyes hurriedly. I gave Chandler the faintest ghost of a nod of thanks, and he twitched his eyebrows in acknowledgement.
Look, you guys are worried about nothing. You told me you want me as a liaison with Winter. Fine, I'm liaising. Mab told me to keep an eye on Lara, I said,
and was technically more or less not lying.
And I came out to talk to her.
Ramirez nodded. What'd you find out?
She says she's got no idea why he did it, I said. Right now it looks like she means to disavow him in front of the Accorded Nations.
And you believe her? Ramirez asked.
No reason not to, I said.
Yoshimo hissed. Vampires are not to be trusted. The intensity of the words was, kind of threatening, really.
I'm not trusting a vampire, I said to her. I'm trusting my reason. Lara Wraith has been all about supporting the Accords. These peace talks are going to be a major test of them. She wouldn't do anything to rock the boat this hard right before they're due to begin.
Unless she has deeper plans, this is only part of them, Ramirez said. He glanced at Yoshimo and nodded.
Yoshimo looked at me, frowned, and started to say something. Wild Bill put a hand on her shoulder. She glanced back and up at him, some strain visible briefly in her expression. Then she smoothed it out into a mask again. Then she came toward me, hands empty, and stopped a couple of feet in front of me. I found myself tensing. When I did, up came Yoshimo and Wild Bill's guns, not quite pointing at me, fingers not actually resting on triggers, but the barrels were only a twitch away from being locked on my chest. At this range, professionals wouldn't miss.
Easy, Chandler said, his voice extremely calm and smooth. Easy, everyone. Let's not make this into something it doesn't have to be.
What the hell is going on here, people? I asked.
We're trying to help you, Harry, Ramirez said, his voice like stone. But you sure as hell aren't making it easy.
Putting a tracker on me? I asked, much more mildly than I felt at the moment. Pulling over my car, pointing weapons at me? You've got a damn peculiar idea of what help looks like, Carlos.
We have to know that you haven't been compromised, Chandler said in that same soothing tone. Dresden, be reasonable. The last time a member of the council operating at your level went bad, he bound the head of the wardens under Aegeus, provided untold amounts of intelligence to our enemies, resulting in tens of thousands of deaths, and summoned a mist fiend that could have wiped out most of the White Council.
You think I'm another Peabody? I snarled.
I think everyone here wants to show the council that you aren't, Chandler said. He held up his hands helplessly. We're living in unstable times and playing for very high stakes, Harry.
We're friends, I said.
Then let us be your friends, Chandler said, his voice all but pleading.
Yoshimo is just gathering evidence, Ramirez said. She isn't going to hurt you.
I clenched my jaw a couple of times. The last time I'd faced off with this many wardens, they'd been there to arrest me after the death of Justin de Morn. I'd been 16. I remember how frightening those grim Spartan figures had been. And those people hadn't been through a war like these guys had. Fighting like mad against a relentless Red Court, always on the back foot, struggling to survive. And eventually turning the tide to a long and ugly stalemate. It was possible that I was looking at the most combat-experienced, dangerous team of wardens on the planet. I knew them. They knew me. A fight between us would be something swift and ugly, and no one would play fair or pull punches. I'd taught them better than that.
Bear in mind, I said in a very quiet voice, that any spell you cast upon me, you're also casting upon Mab's left hand and personal headsman. If this is a sucker punch, she might take it personally. She might even get angry about it.
For several seconds after that, you could hear the trees breathing, while Bill and Chandler traded a look.
Do it, Ramirez said. Yoshimo lowered her rifle until it hung from its strap. Then she lifted her hands, made a few sharp-cornered passes with them, and murmured something low and harsh-sounding.
There was, as I had expected, a fluttering of breeze around her in time with the movements of her hands, then a rush of air and a reciprocal fluttering around Yoshimo. She made a few more precise, geometric movements with her hands, and the air around her flickered with sparks of red and amber light. Yoshimo studied the flickers for a moment and frowned, then slashed a hand at the air and ended the spell. She looked away from me.
Well, Ramirez said.
He's been with at least one sexual partner in the past several hours, Yoshimo said.
Her voice was smooth and calm on the surface, but there was boiling, acidic anger underneath. And as I realized what they'd been doing, my own anger started swelling dangerously. The council had poked its nose in my business my entire adult life. It didn't need to start poking it there. My heart started beating faster.
Who was it? Ramirez asked me, voice hard.
The nerve, I snarled.
Was it Lara? He pressed, his jaw set like stone.
Harry, has she gotten to you?
My fingers tightened on my staff until the wood creaked. You're crossing a goddamn line, Carlos.
Harry, Chandler began, his tone soothing. He reached out to put a companionable hand on my shoulder. I struck it away. Chandler hissed and withdrew his arm, holding it close to his body.
We have to know, Dresden, Ramirez said. Who did you sleep with tonight?
Because your sex life is a disaster, you pull this crap on me, I growled.
Carlos's face drained of color, but his expression never changed.
Believe it. Who?
Suddenly I remember why I have authority issues, I said. Go fuck yourself, Ramirez, and tell whoever ordered you to do this to me to pound sand while you're at it.
Captain Lucio ordered me to do this, Ramirez said quietly.
She's still your friend. She wants to help you, too.
I don't need this kind of help, I said. We're supposed to be on the same side.
We are, Chandler said emphatically, and his face fell.
Unless we aren't, I suppose.
Every word I've said to you is true, I snapped.
Or at least not a lie.
I've had enough bullshit from the White Council for one night.
Harry, let's sort this out with the captain, Chandler said. Come back to Edinburgh with us. Let's talk this out, yes?
It was a rational suggestion, and it was completely unacceptable, because Thomas did not have time for me to spend a full day in a hostile debriefing back in Edinburgh. Those things were thorough and exhausting. It was possible I'd gone through them maybe once or twice. That gave me little choice.
I've been talking, I said. You aren't listening. The problem is on your end, I glared at Ramirez. I've got a lot of work to do. Get out of the road, or arrest me.
I grounded my staff and shook my shield bracelet clear of my sleeve. If you can. Things got real quiet. No one took their eyes off me, but everyone's attention was on Ramirez. He exhaled slowly, then he said,
My God, Harry, you don't make it easy, do you?
Of the two of us here, I said, which of us has definitely wronged the other? You suspect that I might have done something wrong. You've definitely wronged me trying to find out, and you did it first.
We've both done things we'd rather not have as wardens, he answered. That's a job.
He shook his head and, leaning heavily on the cane, limped out of the road.
6 o'clock tomorrow, security meeting at the Four Seasons before the mixer. We're registered under McCoy.
I tilted my head and narrowed my eyes.
I'm still on the team, huh?
Keep your friends close, Ramirez said. I huffed out a breath in a parody of a laugh and turned back toward the Munstermobile.
Harry, Ramirez said.
I paused without looking back at him.
I hope I'm wrong, he said. I hope I need to apologize to you later. God, I would love to do that. Please believe that much is true. For a second, I felt nothing but tired. Secrets are heavy, heavy things. Carry around too many of them for too long, and the weight will crush the life out of you. I wanted to tell everyone to take a walk, talk to Ramirez alone, and tell him everything. Carlos was a good man. He'd do the right thing. But the professional paranoia of the White Council made that impossible. Hell, if they thought I'd been subverted, they would regard the fact that I wanted to talk to him alone as proof that I was, myself, trying to isolate Ramirez so that he could be subverted as well. The other wardens might not even let me have the conversation. And even if I did, if Carlos really thought I'd been made into someone's sock puppet, he might talk with me and report everything I'd said back to the council in an effort to discover what disinformation I'd been trying to give them. If he knew I meant to free Thomas, he'd have excellent reason to have me detained, to prevent an incident that could rapidly spiral out of control. Fear is a prison. But when you combine it with secrets, it becomes especially toxic, vicious. It puts us all into solitary, unable to hear one another clearly. You are, I said tonelessly. You do. Then I got into my car and got moving again. Alone. Chapter 16. I was tired and sick, which isn't the best frame of mind to be in when you're doing detail-oriented work, but I wasn't sure how else to proceed. Screw it. If I had to do this alone, I would. I started planning ahead. So, after eating some fast food, I stopped at the trucker station at the highway and bought a shower. I rinsed off meticulously and at length until I was sure that Ramirez's tracking spell had lost its hold on me. I also scrubbed off the ink spot along with a couple of layers of skin so that he wouldn't be able to get it to lock on again. Once that was done, I made some purchases and headed back out. I needed some isolation, so I picked a random direction away from the crowds and started following my instincts, doing so until I was damn sure I wasn't being physically followed. I wound up at the Illinois Beach State Park as the sky in the east was just turning deep blue after several hours of black. It's about 7 miles of the shoreline of Lake Michigan, mostly pebbles and dunes and marshes with low scrub brush and the occasional larger stand of trees. I found parking in a church lot not too far from the park, took my stuff, and headed in. The park wasn't due to open until well after sunrise, so I'd have to keep an eye out for rangers and other amateur meddlers. The professionals were at work here. Which was just as well. When you summon a powerful, extra-dimensional being, you're taking on a lot of responsibility. First of all, you're bringing something powerful and dangerous into the world. It doesn't matter if you're trying to call down an angel or whistle up one of the fallen. You've got to take that into account. Even benevolent beings, if they're big enough, can kill you without even realizing it's happening until it's too late. Malicious creatures are going to want to kill you as a matter of course. So location is pretty important. So you can maybe have a chance to run for it, first of all. If you can get a location that somehow parallels the nature of the creature you're summoning, it gives you an edge against them, costs less energy to bring them in. Next, containment. In keeping with the theme of part one, you need some way to make sure that the thing you're calling can't just get out and do as it pleases. Most things will simply leave, rendering all that travel to the middle of nowhere a waste of time. Finally, you need some motivation. Beings from beyond the mortal world don't generally work for free. After you talk them out of either leaving or murdering you outright, you'll need something to sweeten the pot. I found the perfect spot after I'd hiked all the way in and reached the lakeshore, with the light changing, announcing the approach of dawn without actually getting any brighter. I wound up at the base of a spit of sandy, pebbly beach that met harshly with a stand of thick trees.
At the base of the largest tree were the crumbled remains of a clearly illegal tree house someone had built a decade or two in the past. I could still find what was left of the slats that had been nailed into the tree trunk to provide an improvised ladder up. Perfect. I set my bag of things down and began laying them out in a circle I drew in the sandy soil with my staff. At the top of the circle went a storm candle and a magazine featuring an image of the weirdest female pop singer operating at the time. She was wearing an outfit made mostly out of old tires and did not look any too warm. The next candle featured a can of cold Dr. Pepper. I popped it open and listened to it hiss out the pressure, then crackle in the quiet of pre-dawn, bubbles bubbling enthusiastically. Beside the next candle, I placed a watermelon ring pop in its plastic wrapper. I opened the wrapper, leaving the jewel-like candy atop it, and the smell of its sweetness and the tangy scent of artificial watermelon filled the air. The next candle featured a sheet of coarse sandpaper, rough side up. I laid my hand on it and moved my palm slowly over the grit and adhesive, feeling it tear gently at my skin. And beside the fifth and last candle went a jar of Nutella. I double-checked the positioning of the ingredients, made sure the circle was closed, and then leaned down and touched it with one finger and an effort of will. The energy whirled about the circle in the sand and sprang up at once in an invisible curtain, enclosing the ground within it, cutting off the circle's interior from the mortal world behind an insulated firewall. Then I closed my eyes, cleared my head, and began whispering a name. Margaret, Catherine, Amanda, Carpenter, I chanted rhythmically. I call you. The candles flickered and danced, though there was no wind. Their colors began to shift and change, seemingly at random, through the spectrum. Margaret, Catherine, Amanda, Carpenter, I whispered, I need you. Behind me, the trees exploded with movement, and I flinched and whirled. A flock of vultures, disturbed from their evening rest, burst into the air, wings flapping in miniature thunder. It took them several seconds to clear out, and then they were gone into the darkness of the air, leaving behind jitters and a few falling black feathers. I took a deep breath and braced my will. Margaret, Catherine, Amanda, Carpenter, I said louder and firmer. We need to talk. Come on, Malls. At the third naming, energy rushed out of me and into the circle. The candles there burst into showers of sparks and a dozen colors, and I had to blink my eyes and look away. And when I looked back, the youngest queen of fairy stood in the circle of power. Molly Carpenter was a tall young woman, and when I looked at her, I always thought of swords and knives these days. She'd gone very lean, living on the streets and fighting the incursions of the Fomor back when I'd been mostly dead. And though her situation had improved, apparently her diet hadn't. Her cheekbones looked like something the TSA would be nervous about letting onto a plane. And that leanness extended to her neck, creating shadows that were a little too deep and sharp. Her blue eyes had always been beautiful, but were they a hint more oblique than they had been? Or was that just clever makeup? The Winter Lady wore a gray business skirt suit with sensible heels and stood with one hip shot out to one side, her fist resting on it. Her silver-white hair was drawn back into a painstakingly neat braid that held it close to her head with no strands escaping. Her expression was nonplussed, and she held a smoldering cell phone in one hand. She regarded the phone for a moment, sighed, and dropped the useless wreck onto the ground. Hey, Malls, I said.
Harry, she said, I have a phone for exactly this reason.
This is a business call, I said in a quiet, low voice, knight to lady. Molly inhaled slowly.
Oh, I see.
Things are getting tense, I said. The wardens have decided I'm a threat. I'm being monitored, and they're doing some kind of cheesy technical weirdness with cell phones now. Couldn't risk a call without Ramirez getting involved in the conversation. Some ugly flicker went across Molly's face at the mention of the wardens. She shook her head, put her hands on her stomach, and said,
"That's the strangest feeling, being summoned."
"That seems like it should be true," I said. "I apologize for the inconvenience." The winter lady stared at me for an unnerving second before she said, in Molly's voice,
"Apology accepted."
She looked around the circle at the objects involved in the summoning and promptly pounced on the jar of Nutella.
"Ah,
payment. Now we're square." She opened the jar, seized the ring pop, and put it on her left forefinger. Then she dipped the ring pop in and closed her eyes as she licked the confection off it.
"Oh, God," she said. "I haven't had food in a day and a half."
"Hell's bells, Padawan," I said. "Nutella and corn syrup is probably not the place to start."
"Probably not," she agreed, and scooped out an even larger dollop.
"You gonna let me out of the circle, or what?"
"Honestly," I said, "I'm a little curious to see if you can do it yourself. I mean, you're still human, too. That circle shouldn't be able to hold Molly."
She lifted her eyebrows.
"Harry, you could put me through a wood chipper if you wanted. I'd get better. Immortal now, remember?"
She lifted a hand and reached out to touch the plane of the circle. The tip of her finger flattened as if pressed against perfectly transparent glass.
"I'm human, but this mantle isn't like yours. It's an order of magnitude more complex. It's not something you put on like a cloak. It's all through me now, intermixed."
She shook her head sadly.
"I could leave this circle, I think, but not without leaving the largest part of me behind. Whatever was left wouldn't be right. Find someone else to experiment with."
A cold feeling kind of spread through me, starting right behind my belt buckle. Because that circle shouldn't have been able to hold Molly. Which meant that the being talking to me wasn't. Not the way I remembered. Molly had taken on the mantle of the Winter Lady and become something that wasn't quite human anymore. She was dealing with forces that I might literally be unable to comprehend. Those pressures might have changed the shape of her, made her into something else, something dangerous.
Which, I thought, must be almost precisely what Ramirez is thinking about you. Molly had definitely become someone darker and more dangerous. But she was still Molly. Still the girl I'd met years ago. Still the young woman I'd trained. Still the woman who'd fought by my side on too many occasions to easily count. My instincts told me that she was someone to be feared. And my instincts were right. But people are often more than one thing. Molly was a very pretty, very dangerous monster now. But she was also the Padawan. She was also my friend. I leaned down and broke the circle with my hand, releasing its energy back into the universe with the subaudible popping sensation. Molly exhaled and calmly stepped out of the circle. She regarded me for a long moment and said,
"God, you look tired."
I tilted my head at her and suddenly smiled.
"You mean old?"
"Weathered," she countered, "like Aragorn."
I laughed at that. As a wizard, I could expect 3 centuries and change, maybe more. I still had a decade and change to go before my body started settling into what it would look like for most of my life.
"Want to know a secret?"
"Always."
"Only the young think being called old is an insult," I said, still smiling. "I am what I am, regardless of what anyone calls it. No one can change it, regardless of what anyone calls it. And it mostly means that nothing has managed to kill me yet."
Molly gave me a small, bitter smile.
One thing did.
I asked for your help with that, I said sternly. You had a hell of a tough choice to make, and you chose loyalty to your friend. I will never forget that, Molly.
Neither will I, she said quietly. I pursed my lips. There was no guilt like wizard guilt, because there is no arrogance like wizard arrogance. We get used to having so much power, so much ability to change things, that we also tend to assume that whatever happens is also our responsibility.
Throw in a few shreds of human decency where you actually worry about the results of your actions upon others, and you wind up with a lot of regrets. Because it's hard. It's really, really hard. In fact, damn near impossible to exercise power without it having some unexpected consequences. Doesn't matter what kind of power it is, magic, muscle, political office, electricity, moral authority. Use any of it, and you're going to find out that as a result, things happen that you didn't expect. When those consequences are a blown light bulb, no big deal. But sometimes people get hurt. Sometimes they die. Sometimes innocence. Sometimes friends. Molly probably wasn't going to forgive herself for assisting in what had amounted to a very complicated near-suicide. There'd been a lot of fallout on every conceivable scale. Very little of it had been Molly's fault, directly or otherwise. But she'd been a mover on that scene, and she probably felt at least as bad as I did about it, and I'd been way more in the middle of things. And, being a wizard, I felt guilty as hell for walking her into that. I hadn't had much choice if I wanted to save my daughter's life, but though the cost was worthy, it still had to be paid, and Molly had laid down cold, hard cash. So cold and so hard that Mab had wound up choosing her to be the new Winter Lady, in fact. Suddenly, I wondered if maybe I hadn't been hard enough on myself. I mean, hell. At least when I'd become the Winter Knight, I'd made a choice. My back had been to a wall and my options had all sucked. But I'd at least sought out my bargain with Mab. Molly hadn't been consulted, and Mab's policy on dissenting opinion was crystalline. Deal with it or die. Of course, for inveterate dissenters like myself, it created a pretty simple counter-policy for when I was tired of Mab's crap. Deal with it or kill me. Mab was a lot of things, but irrational wasn't one of them. And as long as it was easier to put up with me than replace me, we had attained a state of balance. I imagined that Molly had come to similar arrangements. I put my hand on her shoulder, squeezed slightly, and gave her another smile. Hey, it was hard for everyone, but we came through it. And with all these scars, we have to have learned a lesson somewhere, right? I'm not sure how well that logic holds up, she said, giving me a wry smile. I think of it as an idiot's version of optimism, I said. I eyed the lightening sky. How up are you on current events? She glanced that way as well. I've been working in Eastern Russia for 2 weeks, she said. I'm busy as hell. Okay, I said, and I caught her up on recent events. Everything. Except for Butters and Andy and Marcy, because Butters had asked me, and because I wasn't quite sure what to think about that myself. Before we go any further, and just to be clear, she asked, did my apartment actually burn down? No. She nodded and exhaled. So, let's see. She closed her eyes and thought for a moment about what I had told her. Oh, God. You're going to go get Thomas, aren't you? I'm exhausting all possibilities for a diplomatic solution first, I said. She gave me a wary look. I like the Svartovs, I explained. They're good people, and they've got kids. I'm not going to wade into them, guns blazing. Her eyebrows went up. And you think I can get something done? The Svartovs like you, I said. As far as I can tell, you're an honorary Svartov.
and every single one of them is a sucker for pretty girls, and that's you also.
A flicker of her hand acknowledged fact without preening.
I think you're overestimating my influence in the face of events like this, she said.
Etri and his people are old school. Blood has been spilled. There's going to be an accounting, period.